God was so disturbed that he couldn't, he wasn't writing. And Kamal Krishna Maharaj was encouraging him, Prabhupada, you should write, it'll make you feel better. And Prabhupada said, it's not, don't force me, it's not mechanical. It has to come from inspiration. And some days it happens, some days it doesn't. Or it's really difficult. I just mentioned that because today was a difficult day. Sages, thus deluded by affection, he began to speak. King Yudhisthira, son of Dharma,
overwhelmed by the death of his friends,
was aggrieved just like a common materialistic man. O sages, thus deluded by affection, he began to speak. Purport. King Yudhisthira, though he was not expected to become aggrieved like a common man, became deluded by worldly affection by the will of the Lord, just as Arjuna was apparently deluded. A man who sees knows well that the living entity is neither the body nor the mind, but is transcendental to the material conception of life. The common man thinks of violence and nonviolence in terms of the body, but that is a kind of delusion. Everyone is duty-bound according to one's occupational duties. A kshatriya is bound to fight for the right cause, regardless of the opposite party. In such discharge of duty, one should not be disturbed by annihilation of the material body, which is only an external dress of the living soul. All this was perfectly known to Maharaj Yudhisthira, but by the will of the Lord, he became just like a common man because there was another great idea behind this delusion. The king would be instructed by Bhishma as Arjuna was instructed by the Lord himself. Om Jnana Timirandasya Jnanam Jana Salakaya Chakshurum Vitam Dina Tasmai Shri Guru Vemaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Vatanam
Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Ram Hare Ram Ram Ram
King Yudhisthira, son of Dharma, overwhelmed by the death of his friends, was aggrieved just like a common materialistic man. O sages, thus deluded by affection, he began to speak. Here, this phrase, aggrieved like a common materialistic man. Implies that the devotees also grieve. It is not that devotees are not supposed to grieve, but not supposed to grieve like materialistic men. There's often somewhat of a false notion, which is somewhat an impersonal notion, that devotees are sort of stone-like. They don't get sukha, dukkha, smekutva. They neither get happy, they neither lament, they neither feel any of these things. They're just by equipoise, meaning that they don't feel or exhibit anything. But that's not true. We see that the goal of Krishna consciousness is to exhibit transcendental emotion, to experience it and exhibit it. And in the process of getting there, devotees will also experience and exhibit, and those transcendental emotions are the pure form of these things like happiness, distress. And in getting to that stage, one also experiences sort of spiritualized, not fully spiritual, but spiritualized emotions. And the real distinction between the two is what we see here with Yudhisthira Maharaj, and the same thing that Srila Prabhupada points out transpired with Arjuna. And that is that one actually forgets the knowledge or loses the transcendental knowledge upon which one experiences or feels. For instance, Arjuna's thinking that if I have to fight, this will be the death of my relatives. Krishna points out that the relatives are not going to die. Their bodies are going to die, but they're not going to die. Now, the fact that their bodies are going to die is a reality. So Srila Prabhupada here uses this word
that it's a kind of some, what does he say? A kind of delusion. In other words, it is unfortunate that when people leave their body, it's unfortunate in the sense that we no longer associate with them because we associate with bodies. We associate through our material body, which is our instrument for devotional service. So when, for instance, a Vaishnava leaves this world, why are we lamenting? It's, you know, we sing this very poignant song of Narottam Das Thakur at the disappearance of all Vaishnavas. Why? And it's all about, he's just lamenting. So what's the difference between that lamentation and this lamentation? Because he's not thinking that it's, the person's finished, the person's gone. He realizes the soul is eternal, but I'm no longer able to associate with that soul through the medium of a manifest body. Therefore, how will I get their association? And it's with this type of knowledge that makes devotees' expressions of, in this case, grief valid. When the grief is in ignorance of the identity of the soul, the eternality of the soul, the inevitability of having to give up the body, and so many other important points that Krishna makes throughout the Gita, then that's maya. And the same thing for happiness. For instance, a very sort of intense type of happiness that people experience is having children, right? When you get children, and at least until they start to give you headaches. But, and so that's natural. You know, you see this picture in Prabhupada Lilamrita of this little baby who just stands, and Prabhupada's, you know, he's like, he's in ecstasy that this child's standing. So, Prabhupada's both experiencing and feeling something. He's showing, oh, what a far out thing. This child's taking his first step. Srila Prabhupada's not thinking, this is the most important thing in life. He's not in illusion that, you know, this child is that body, that his family is the all in all, and that these are the real measures of happiness and success in life. But he's also not oblivious to the fact that, you know, this is a major step in a living entity's coming of childhood, in this case, learning how to walk. And he can enjoy that. You know, like in another instance, when Srila Prabhupada was on the plane, and he was watching a Charlie Chaplin movie, and all the devotees, and Prabhupada was laughing, and the devotees didn't know what to do. You know, so I thought, we're not supposed to look at that. And then when I look at Prabhupada, Prabhupada's like laughing. So when Srila Prabhupada explained that, he said, well, yes, where does the sense of humor come from? He said, it comes from Krishna. So I'm enjoying that sense of humor as I'm seeing it in relationship to Krishna. And we read so many humorous escapades of Krishna, like in Nectar of Devotion. He's full of them. So once again, it's emotion. This time it's laughter. So laughing, crying, and these things, when in the, on the context of Krishna consciousness, on the basis of real knowledge, then they may come. And when we, and they're part and parcel of our being devotees, our being human beings. But when we get in another situation, for instance, in the example of that child, we think, we just forget everything. You know, we forget that this is a soul who's come to me for, or who's been given to me to be taken care of, to be guided towards Krishna, and like materialistic people do, it's the all in all, it's the everything, and the body's everything, and give them anything, you know, stick them in front of the TV all day long, get them all kinds of silly games and toys that have no real practical value, stuff them full of poisonous food. That's not the right type of happiness or enjoyment. So Yudhisthira Maharaj, he's Krishna's associate, he's a transcendental personality. So here it's described that he's grieving now at the end of the war, which you can imagine just what a, however many people were dying, whether it's 6 million or 60 million, but there's a lot of carnage going on, and this is going on just in the period of 18 days, which is, and it's in one place. If you consider that in the Second World War, 30 million people died, but that was over a period of 5 years, and it spread out all over the world. Now they make a big ado that, you know, since the Iraqi war started some years ago, 3,000 American soldiers have died. It's not, on D-Day, when the Allies landed in Germany, they lost 100,000 soldiers on the landing. And that was within a few hours. So 3,000 soldiers in years. So they measure things in a different way. So that must be a very really impressive thing. You have these millions of people dying in a matter of just a few days, just on one battlefield, that unless they clear them off at night, they can't fight the next day because the whole battlefield is so littered with bodies and chariots. So all night long you've got between the Rakshasas eating the corpses and other barriers and other carriers, people whose duty it was to sort of assist, they're like clearing it off so they could fight again. Now that had a great impression on Yudhisthira Maharaj, and he's realizing he's got all of these widows with their children and families, and a lot of these are aristocratic people, their family relatives crying on his shoulder, because now it's his duty. He won the war, but the result of winning the war is he's got to take care of all of these people. And so he just becomes, he forgot. What did he forget? He forgot that Krishna is the one who stood there for 45 minutes, an hour, speaking to Arjuna why he should fight. And now he's getting back into the same situation, lamenting in the same way, lamenting after the fact, when Arjuna was lamenting before the fact, that more or less they were doing the same thing. And he forgot that, in this case, aside from forgetting the eternality of the soul, what does Srila Prabhupada say? He forgot that this is his duty. It may be a painful outcome, and very often we find that to do our duty is not always, the result of it is not always, you know, enjoyment and happiness. Sometimes doing one's duty, there are unhappy situations, circumstances that comes as a consequence of that. But we have this word in English, duty bound. But being duty bound is the theme of Bhagavad Gita. The theme of Bhagavad Gita is for people to learn how to do their duty. And that is really also the basis of sadhana bhakti, being a sadhaka. Because unless you learn how to act out of duty, then you can't attract Krishna's attention, or you can't really enter into the real realm of devotion. Duty precedes bhakti. Devotional service means that you spontaneously do what you need to do because you have a feeling or a desire under all circumstances that whatever it takes, I want to please Krishna. But that means that someone's advanced. That means that his heart is already pure. That he's in such a situation that wherever he is and whatever he's doing, he's just thinking, how can I please Krishna? But when one doesn't have that, and it's natural that, you know, when we are coming to Krishna consciousness, even practicing Krishna consciousness, that we don't have that mood immediately. But still, things need to be done. And that's what being duty-bound is. Is that, all right, I don't have the overriding desire to please Krishna, but I know that this is what pleases Krishna, and whether I like to do it or don't like to do it, I should do it anyway. And then less advanced than that is when people become selective and think, well, I do something that's according to my nature, and that will please Krishna. So that's also a type of Krishna consciousness, but it's not the same quality of Krishna consciousness as doing what Srila Prabhupada would say, doing the needful. So here, Yudhisthira Maharaj is sort of expressing this same type of mentality of someone who's forgotten that, you know, when you're doing your duty, there's no question of lamenting. You just, that's your business. So, Krishna is asking, Kutastu Kashmalamidam, what is this Kashmalam, this Kashaya, this impurity within your heart? How did you come across this thing? So, because Anaryam Jishtamashvargam Akirti Karamajana, because if it's first of all, it's Anarya. This type of lamentation or this type of ignorance is Anarya. And Arya means like guru or respectable person. So when a whole society is respectable, and that's sort of an indirect way of saying how do people become respectable? They become respectable when they have elevated consciousness. You know, in the Second World, or at least the whole outbreak of the Second World War was based upon Hitler having this concept of Aryans, which he adopted from Vedic culture, because the Germans, amongst everyone in Europe, when Europe sort of became interested in India, the Germans were like most into Indian culture. They were most into Sanskrit language, studying the Vedic literatures and so on. So they were, and he got this whole idea of being an Aryan, Aryan meaning a superior race, a race of, but his was on the basis of the body. He thought that, you know, someone who's the strongest and the best looking and blonde haired and so on, that there must be Aryans. But no, Arya means respectable, and you become respectable not by your looks or your physique, but by your consciousness, by your way of thinking. So Krishna says, Anaryam, but you're behaving like someone who doesn't have elevated consciousness, Akirti. And the result of this is that you're going to be disrespected amongst respectable people who just ignore you. And similar situation here. It's interesting because Krishna said, Kutastu, how did you get in this situation? And of course the answer was here is that, well, you put me in this situation, so why are you asking me how to get in this situation? But because Krishna did put Arjuna in that situation, Arjuna's not thinking like that. He's just like overwhelmed. And Yudhisthira Maharaj also, which is sort of an interesting point or an interesting situation, that Krishna puts devotees into what Srila Prabhupada says, apparently deluded. And it should be clear that it's sort of an apparent delusion. It looks like Maya, but it's not the external energy acting, it's the internal potency. Now, external potency is just a shadow of the internal potency. So in one sense, they're one, but they act differently. Here, the same thing is there. is that the Yudhisthira Maharaj is under Yoga Maya, but Yoga Maya now is acting in such a way as to make him actually forget that thing. Now, how do you know that it's Yoga Maya? Because just like Arjuna, he's not walking away from Krishna. Remember, Yoga Maya means you're always connected to Krishna. So here, same situation. Krishna is there, as in Kurukshetra. Krishna is also there, because this is also Kurukshetra. He's also there, and Yudhisthira Maharaj isn't becoming inimical towards him, isn't leaving away, looking, I'm going to look for some kind of other solution. But he's also turning to Krishna, and turning to devotees to solve my problem. And as long as one doesn't forget Krishna, then it should be seen that this type of bewilderment is not ordinary. Krishna sometimes puts devotees in such situations. But it's something that should really be confirmed by acharyas like that. Otherwise, the tendency, or what will happen, is that devotees can very easily say that, well, my being in Maya or my being in illusion is Krishna's arrangement. But that's not what's happening here. This is something very exceptional, because there's two ways of teaching. You teach people what to do, and then you also teach people what not to do. What not to do, we got lots of experience. But here, we have lots of experience because we're always doing the wrong thing, or generally we end up doing the wrong thing. Those people who are deluded by the material energy do the wrong thing. Why does Krishna use devotees, Yudhisthira Maharaj, Arjuna, to teach what not to do? Because by using them to teach what not to do, then you learn what to do, which is the difference between devotees being in this situation and non-devotees. So a devotee being in a situation of bewilderment, because he always turns to Krishna, he shows what to do by accepting Krishna's instruction, and then nasto mahasmiti brahma harishe vachanam tava ajunsan adu kise. So, but there's no guarantee that a conditioned soul is going to react like that. In fact, most likely that he's not going to. So this is why Krishna actually uses exalted personalities, and sometimes places them in a trying situation, because in that situation, because they are exalted persons, when they're given advice, they will react the right way. But conditioned souls won't react the right way. So therefore, they're not suitable examples for others. So that's why it becomes then Arjuna, or Yudhisthira Maharaj, or even Lord Shiva, in the case of Mohini Murti, and other examples that we see in Bhagavatam, because put under stress and pressure, these personalities don't turn away from Krishna. They just show you how at times of difficulty, in which we're all bound to be in throughout life, how someone is meant to react. And Krishna knows they will always react the right way because they are devotees. So it's apparent. It's an apparent illusion. And then we see if someone doesn't react the right way, then it's been very obvious, well, this isn't Krishna's arrangement, because what benefit is that? But generally we should avoid that type of consciousness or that type of logic, thinking that, you know, Krishna put me into Maya. All the examples have already been given by great personalities and recorded in Shastra, so that we know that this is actually some type of authorized delusion, not accepting material energy for the spiritual energy. And that's really the basic qualification of a Vaishnava, is he knows the difference between matter and spirit. He knows what's material, he knows what's spiritual, he knows what's Maya, and he knows what's Krishna. And until one does, Krishna says, person who doesn't know the difference between what's right and wrong is still bewildered by the mode of ignorance. He's still bewildered by that same type of energy that leads demons along. So it's not a high qualification. But here we see that Yudhisthira Maharaj is showing these symptoms, and that's the point. Different emotional exchanges are not outlawed in Krishna consciousness, but they shouldn't be done in ignorance of the realities, of the principles, of the tattva of Krishna consciousness. Those should always be there and should always be intact. And let me stop instead. Devotees have any questions? And then I'll be tomorrow and continue on. Yudhisthira Maharaj is starting to lament. We hear about his lamentation.
There's some Shastric quote to funeral, how long to grieve for, but a Sudra grieves for 7 hours, and then the more qualified people, they grieve. But that grieving period is
like 30 days, and 30 days up to 14 or 12 days or 11 days. What was the question?
Well, the question was, you know, Rose, I'm in a situation here where a small child dies, so thinking, you know, there's a grieving period which is natural for the parents. Some of those were thinking, well, it should, you know, just be devoted to transcendental. It usually goes back to Vaikuntha. So there should be any grieving. So according to Shastra, as far as I understood, that there is a grieving period allowed.
Yes. Well, allowed. It states formally. I've seen it in India where it's like an organized thing, where there's a death in the family, and then you get the ladies of the village. And for instance, with the ladies of the family, they go from house to house crying. Well, that's what they do. Literally, they cry. And I've seen them walking from them. And there's like this whole group, instead of, you know, doing kirtan, they're just crying, and they go and they cry, and because it allows for an actual expression of emotion, which, you know, even a modern psychiatrist, if you don't show emotion, if you suppress it, then that becomes a source of other types of problems. So that's why that sort of grieving is there, is that people are encouraged in that sense to grieve, but it shouldn't be done in ignorance, and we should be transcendental. It's interesting, even when Srila Prabhupada was laying on his deathbed, and he was talking about his wife, and Prabhupada, when he was talking about his wife, Prabhupada was crying, just because he, you know, felt emotion for a living entity that he lived with for, I don't know, 30 years or so, 40 years, someone who participated in his journey in serving Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's mission, and that he felt obliged, so he made arrangements that when I die that they should get so much money a month. And it's not because Prabhupada felt, or, you know, Prabhupada was, he's complaining that the Indians were just not giving him facility, not Indians, India. Was the government of India wasn't giving him facilities, couldn't even bring devotees there, wouldn't give proper visas and so on. And then he started talking about America. So about America, they helped me, they encouraged me, and then Prabhupada started, you know, crying. So was Prabhupada, you know, attached to some kind of country? But he, he wasn't, you know, showing some kind of mundane patriotic streak. He was just thankful, and he was feeling that. So yeah, it's when, you know, child leaves, living entity leaves, Prabhupada makes that statement. It's natural to have affection for children. It's just a natural thing for parents. I mean, suidam sarabhutanam, the devotee is meant to be affectionate, your friend. You can't be a friend unless you're affectionate. So you're meant to have affection. And transcendental, I gave those examples. Prabhupada is transcendental. That doesn't mean, what does transcendental mean? That you become stone. That's not what transcendental means. It's just, you be, but you're not, you don't forget.
Something else as well, when it's similar, when you're on Sankirtan, say for instance you're in the middle of a mountain, and it seems sometimes that Krishna opens doors that wouldn't normally open when you're absorbed in Sankirtan or in the morning service. So how do we tell sometimes on Sankirtan as well that if you're not being very Krishna conscious, or you're not being very Krishna conscious, and then things happen and just block. So how can we tell what's Krishna's arrangement on Sankirtan and what's just our laziness or our mind in terms of, you know, practically on Sankirtan, where Krishna seems to make arrangements that sometimes and other times he doesn't. And sometimes the arrangements that seem to be made aren't, they don't look like they're faithful, but they turn out to be faithful.
Well, when Krishna was, you know, the cowherd boys, they got discouraged because they got turned away by the brahmanas. And Krishna said, you know, hey, don't get upset, because this is the way of begging. Is that sometimes people give and sometimes don't. He wasn't making any kind of argument that, you know, he was responsible at that time. He says, This is the way it is. And it may not necessarily be, we make a statement and we can make a statement it's Krishna's arrangement. Because devotees tend to see things like that, either directly or indirectly. But there's so many factors involved when one is actually on Sankirtan. The individual person's karma, the devotee's effort, the devotee's consciousness, Krishna's doing something special at that particular time. And all of those combined make it even really difficult to decipher just exactly what is the overriding factor. But because devotees are directly under Krishna's guidance, so we can, you know, can see that things transpiring or taking place to us are either being arranged by Krishna or they're being allowed to take place by Krishna. I don't know if that exactly answered the question. And whether a Sankirtan devotee is, you know, whether it's known that something is Maya or Krishna. Well, Maya is that which keeps us and other people away from Krishna. And Krishna consciousness is that which brings people close to Krishna. So when we're even making the effort, whatever our state of consciousness, to bring people close to Krishna, even trying to overcome our own minds and so on, then we should understand that we're under Krishna's protection in that situation. And when we forget that, and you know, we become We forget either our duty, we forget our relationship, we give up the fight and we stop struggling, and we just really become a victim of our minds, then we can see that that's Maya. However, because devotees are very dear to Krishna, even when they're Maya, he may step in just in order to bring them back in the same way that he did to that Krishna Das, who was Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's servant. So he really turned away from Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, but still Chaitanya Mahaprabhu took the initiative in order to try to save him. And that's because devotees are taking a real risk. So why does Krishna do that? Because being on Sankirtan is really taking a risk on Krishna's behalf. So therefore, unless we really, really become overwhelmed and bewildered and we're super determined to get into Maya, that we may find that even sometimes when we appear to be completely out of it, something happens in order to get us back into it. And generally what happens is some good result. And because when we get a good result, then we immediately brighten up. And when you brighten up, then it's easier to be Krishna conscious than when you're not. And that's Chaitanya Mahaprabhu responding to the fact that, you know, realizes that if we're sitting back here in the temple, there's a good likelihood that we wouldn't be in so much Maya. But the fact that we're out there doing it for him is in part, if not in whole, responsible for our lack of enthusiasm or Krishna consciousness. So then he steps in and gives a nudge. Therefore, generally, as long as the overall result comes, the overall result is if we came back at the end of the day, then we see this Krishna's arrangement. But if you really turn away, then say this person really succumbed to Maya. Because Lord Chaitanya may sort of intervene, but it ultimately is not going to take away our free will. You had that question. No, you had that question yesterday about Bhagavad Gita.
Yes, there's a question arose specifically about two purports of Bhagavad Gita, which one was chapter 8 text. Bhagavad Gita is something from the bookshelf, Maharaj.
Oh, I thought this was a Gita. Details of all these arguments. I mean, one is the principle behind it, and the other one is whether Srila Prabhupada had said such thing. And Jai Dvaita Maharaj is the person who ultimately is both knowledgeable and responsible for these things. I kind of doubt that they'd stick something in that Srila Prabhupada never said. But in many places, or many times, devotees have real difficulty in understanding Srila Prabhupada, especially in the early days. They had a problem not being used to his accent, and Prabhupada's accent, if you listen to tapes, it's really stronger in the beginning than in the later on, when he's used to speaking. And so devotees misunderstood a lot of things. No doubt that if you look at the tikkas or commentaries of probably Baladeva Vibhushan and Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, they're the ones who use this word. And for a reason, either a reason most likely that it was misunderstood or and therefore not included at that time, they now concluded that this was the particular word. I mean, I'm just, I don't know, because I'm just guessing that is the reason, although there may be others. However, in terms of the principle of, you know, are we changing the Gita, and that this is no longer bona fide, but something earlier was bona fide. From, you know, someone who writes, and particularly I have to deal a lot of times with translations of texts, and I studied how Srila Prabhupada writes. Prabhupada doesn't write verbatim. He doesn't translate verbatim. He writes and translates for meaning. The arguments that, I think that was his name, Mark Martinson, or something like that. Anyway, he's not in the shape. There's no reason to call him by the way. He just gave himself that name. This type of logic or this type of argument is the same problem that academics have with Prabhupada's books, is that Prabhupada does not translate, and Prabhupada says there's two ways of translating. One is you just literally translate, and the other one is you translate for meaning. Srila Prabhupada's methodology is translating for meaning, which means that if not always, but almost always, Prabhupada says things that aren't, they're not even in the purport, I mean the text. And he said he does that because that clarifies the meaning of what's actually being stated. And that's not Prabhupada's system, that's an authentic system. It's also part of any translation tradition, is you translate so that people who read what you have translated actually understand it. And Srila Prabhupada really does do that in his books. Really, really does that. To the extent that, you know, sometimes the words in a translation, half the words may not even be there in the Sanskrit. And that's his license. So the point being is that is whatever the form Srila Prabhupada's original Gita is it supposed to stay in that form for the next 10,000 years? Now I would say no. You just study Chaucer. Chaucer was when? 700-800 years ago. Can't make head or tail of what he's saying. He's speaking English language, but English language has changed so much in those years that it's like it's another language. And the English language, you all notice, is changing. And there's words, you know, that we're using now that didn't exist when you went to school. And what's going to be In other words, when the English language changes in such a way that 200 years from now, no one's going to understand a word of what's being going on here. Are we blindly bound to just stick with these because these are the actual words that Prabhupada used? Or are we supposed to make what Prabhupada said understandable to people in that time? Because the whole method of communication, not the method, but the words of communication have completely changed. And, the Prabhupada that I know is not interested in that type of ritualistic thing where, no, we're not going to change these words. We don't care if people understand what Prabhupada wrote. We're just going to make sure that it stays like that because that's pure. It's ridiculous. I mean, and that's just one example. Of course, Srila Prabhupada was also very particular about devotees not changing what he wrote. But he wanted to make sure devotees don't change the meanings of what he wrote and don't take that type of initiative on their own, particularly when he was physically present without consulting him. Unfortunately, Srila Prabhupada is not present, therefore they have to take responsibility, but it shouldn't be the responsibility of individuals, it should be the responsibility of, in this case, the BBT and BBT trustees. But ultimately, you're going to have to face these type of realities that the language will change, and even the words that you're using here may be non-existent, they may change their meaning, and they'll mean nothing to people when they're reading this book, even Victorian English when we read it. Say that the words are the same and they mean the same thing, but it's so laborious that if you try to, for instance, read Bhagavad Gita in Victorian English, which is just like, a little over 100 years ago, people just put it down. So what do? We just keep the language such that, it's too much of a stress for people to read just so that we can say it's pure. But that's not our concept of purity, isn't that you're keeping all the words. This is Vedic mantras, is that you don't change syllables, words, everything. But it's not the Bhagavad system. Bhagavad system is that you keep the message pure. And that requires realization. The message has to be pure, but the words may change. So for me, that's the more important of the thing, is to where, I don't know where this word came from, and I'm just sort of giving a hypothetical example of where it could have come from. But one thing for sure is that the meaning of what Srila Prabhupada is saying and the meaning of the text, that's what really has to be conserved under all costs. So, it bewildered people. Anyone who initiates himself will be bewildered enough not to understand things like this, because he doesn't have the basic understanding of what Krishna consciousness is about. So he doesn't know what authority is, or what the purpose of Prabhupada's statements are. He doesn't follow. So how's he going to understand what Prabhupada's talking about in Bhagavad Gita? There was another one also, but that was a similar example.
The other one was chapter 10,
it's probably, I don't know what was, I don't know what is. I haven't been sort of following the details of that, but I would just use this principle. Is that the principle is that translation and presentation should be for clarity of meaning. And it's an inevitable thing. There are obvious mistakes. Mistakes that the transcribers made. The devotees argue, well, Prabhupada knows everything. We were distributing and he saw the Gita at that time and he didn't change it, so therefore we should leave it as it is. That's like a real weird idea of who Srila Prabhupada is. Like he's supposed to be some all-knowing personality, and if there was something wrong, then he would have automatically known and said. So, no. sense is like that also. Which one? Which one is it here?
Seven lines from the end of the third quarter of text 34. And the ability of the soul.
10:34?
Yes.
Seven lines from the end of the third quarter.
And the ability not only to read many books on different subject matters, but to understand and apply them when necessary as intelligence. And the other translation, the meaning is, seems to be opposite to that. That we shouldn't read many books, that we shouldn't read many different scriptures.
Unless you go first to what the original texts say. First you need to go to see what's the original tape, what did Srila Prabhupada originally say, and then you need to talk to the people and ask them what it is that inspired them to make a change. And if it's clear that this is what Srila Prabhupada said, and that was just a misunderstanding, then that's very clear. If there's something else, then there's some logic or reason. You know, it isn't that morons just decided to all of a sudden change this thing. They're intelligent people who have as their responsibility to safeguard Srila Prabhupada's message. So they have to be asked what, please explain what this is all about, what the reason and logic behind that. If after studying one can remember a subject matter, he's gifted with good memory, smriti, and the ability not only to read many books on different subject matter, but to understand them and apply them when necessary as intelligence, maybe another option. Anyway, you need those things to be able to see why and what. They're the people who know why. And Jayadeva Maharaj wrote a booklet on the changes, right? And ultimately, it comes down to who's saying what. So if I have to choose between Jayadeva Maharaj and Mark, despite the fact that I don't know anything about the whole topic, then I'll say, well, this was Prabhupada's editor, and I know what he stands for. I sort of know what this other person stands for. So I just, even without knowing anything, I'll just go along with his version, because that's our business. We trust in the integrity of Vaishnavas, and we see who they are, so are who's speaking, who's talking. But I don't know the details of these. Something else.
Yesterday in the class, I didn't quite understand what is the difference between being emotional and being sentimental.
Emotional and sentimental. Well, I don't know. It depends how you define the words. I mean, we have sentiments. We have emotions. Those are the characteristics of the soul. And when those emotions are just expressed in relationship to matter, and when they're not guided by transcendental knowledge, then you could say that someone's being sentimental. In other words, his sentiments, his emotions, his conditioned material emotions are what are guiding his behavior and his thinking. But if someone balances his emotions with transcendental knowledge and spiritualized intelligence, then that's the proper expression of emotions and sentiments. And You know, sometimes people say, well, you know, I have to do what I feel is right. But only do that when you also know that it's right. If all you're doing is just feeling that it's right, but you don't know that it's right, knowing meaning that it's a function of your intelligence, then that's being sentimental. Because, you know, your emotions we can't trust as our praman, as our process of evidence. Our process of evidence has to be sadhu, shastra, guru. That's the rule of thumb for conditioned souls. For liberated souls, they can follow their emotions, because their emotions are truth. But our emotions, even though we may show them, and even though they may be somewhat spiritualized, they're heading in the right direction, but still they're not truth. What's truth is Bhagavad Gita. What's truth is the vision of sadhus. Emotions are not only when, you know, the soul is free from any type of material covering, then you can say that that's fine. Emotions are spiritual. It's sort of like when Srimati Radharani went looking for Krishna and he disguised himself as Narayan. So when she came before that four-handed Krishna, and she felt like she was in Krishna's presence, but he didn't look like Krishna, he looked like Narayan. But then she gave more credence to her feelings, because she's feeling is truth. It's more truth than what she's seeing. And Krishna had to respond to that. But we're not in that type of category. In order to be able to just, you know, I have to do what I feel is right. Because feeling is a very, very subjective thing. So we should know what we know is right, and if there's a conflict between what we know and what we feel, then we should do what we know, not what we feel. And if we don't know, then what someone else knows. So it requires quite a high level of purity of heart in order to be able to just follow your heart. You've got to be in samadhi, you're kinetic, so connected to Krishna. Anything
else? I was just on that kind of same subject where we used to hear a lot, we used to have thinking, feeling, and living like traits of the mind. So therefore, to discriminate between the three, thinking, feeling, and willing, that then require a high level of purified intelligence to actually.
To discriminate between?
What would be a spiritual emotion or a material emotion?
It's not even spiritual, because spiritual emotion is quite an elevated thing. But at least an emotion that's, you know, Prabhupada said, spiritually dovetailed. And yes, one needs to be a knowledge. I mean, that's the whole basis of our Krishna consciousness is, you know, are built around these books to give people knowledge so that they can discriminate when they're, you know, spiritual material is one thing, but at least when you're going in the right direction, when you're going in the spiritual direction as opposed to just going in the material direction. And devotees need to really be versed in in the process of devotional service, in the process of Krishna consciousness. Otherwise, you know, you'll get bewildered. And that's Arjuna was bewildered, so what was Krishna's solution to his bewilderment was to give him knowledge. He didn't tell Arjuna, okay, just sit down and start chanting Hare Krishna. He started speaking. So even that is sort of quite telling what he engaged Arjuna in. He engaged him in hearing to sort of elevate his consciousness from this type of bewilderment that Karapanya Dosho, that all these imperfections that Arjuna was suffering from. So yeah, thinking, feeling, and willing are functions of the mind, but we're using our mind. The question is whether our mind is actually degrading us or it's elevating us. It's not that you're either spiritual or material. More or less what we call Krishna consciousness is that our materially molded mind and senses are being gradually elevated in the direction of transcendence. You know, Srila Prabhupada made the statement that you're either always in Maya. And strictly speaking, we're always in Maya. Until we are free from the modes of material nature, that means we're under the modes of material nature, that's called Maya. So, so until we become free from material energy, but we don't use that terminology, and Prabhupada rarely used it, generally he said, be Krishna conscious, because if you're conscious of Krishna and you're going towards Krishna, even though we still conditioned soul means we're Maya, but we're making the right decisions, we're going in the right direction, even though we're still actually under the influence of modes of material nature. And why? Because our decision making and our actions are protected from the modes of nature by strictly following the transcendental and liberated instructions that we get in Gita and Bhagavatam. So, you know, that the example of the electrician. So he doesn't know, but he just strictly follows the instructions. So in that sense, he's not an electrician. But because he's following very strictly what he should be told about, what he's supposed to do, therefore he's as good as the electrician. And in due course of time, by doing that, then he becomes trained and he becomes qualified. So we're following spiritual instructions, transcendental instructions, although actually we're still laboring under the bodily concept of life. But as long as we strictly adhere to those instructions and guidelines, we're as if we're not under the bodily concept, because we're following instructions that come from the liberated platform and that lead you to liberation. So it's a very good arrangement. We become free, and that's why for us the strict following is very important, because otherwise we're already in a very precarious situation, and that's what's guiding us out. So those instructions are liberated, and when we strictly follow them, then even though we're conditioned, then Prabhupada makes the statement, which just doesn't come to me right now, is that once liberated from, once free from the influence of modes of nature, even though conditioned, once freed, we take shelter of that. But to stay in the shelter of that liberated instructions, we should know what the liberated instructions are, and we should know the process of always being under their shelter. And that's why when we get the experience, you step out, then immediately victimized by our own selves where we are. Anybody else?
sit. We'll have evening program again. We'll go to the hospital in the afternoon, meet with some devotees. That's it. Okay. So then we'll continue with Alder Puja now. That's other work. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai. Hare Krishna.